Welcome to the Online Bodyguard Podcast with host Philip Rendell, CEO and founder of Diffuse, a global threat and intelligence consultancy that blends psychology and intelligence to mitigate threats and risks to prominent people and brands.
Hello, everyone, and welcome once again to the Online Bodyguard. As always, I have a very, very special guest today. And this gentleman has a unique story. A story that will sit aside one of the most, if not the most, historical figure of our lifetimes. And it's a great pleasure because we've been sort of known each other for a while, but we met for the first time recently at a conference and spent some time with drinks chatting about our favourite subject, which was South Africa. And it was just such a joy. So, ladies and gentlemen, Rory Stein. Rory spent 18 years in the South African police, but five of those years were as Nelson Mandela's personal protection officer, his bodyguard. So, Rory, rather than me introduce you, how do you introduce yourself?
Well, good day, Phil, and thank you for the invitation to chat. And it's going to be just that, just two blokes chatting. I think that, you know, obviously those 5 years defined so much of my life, but I always love to just introduce myself as a husband and a father. So I've been married to Jill, who was born in Scotland many years ago. For 37 years, I think it is, this December, we've been married, and we have three boys, and we have a home full of four dogs back in South Africa. And having left the police after those almost 18 years of service in 99, I left the police service on the day that President Mandela worked his last day in office. So our terms of office in South Africa are 5 years. He intentionally only served one, and that was probably a good idea for a number of reasons, one of which was that he was into his early 80s by the time he stepped out of office. 16th of June, which is a very historic date if you know your South African history. And on the 17th of June, I went in and resigned, took early retirement, as it were. And that very night, got on a plane and flew to Heathrow to attend the 99 Cricket World Cup that England was hosting, because Dr. Ali Bacha, who was then the MD of the United Cricket Board of South Africa, now Cricket South Africa, told me that the ICC had whispered in his ear that we would be awarded the 2003 Cricket World Cup, and they'd never had a cricket, a security consultant in South African cricket. So he packed me off to London. And I went to three of the county grounds hosting the 99 World Cup matches, came back, wrote a report, submitted it. He then sent me on a tour of South Africa's international cricket stadiums to do an analysis of what was there, what the gap was, and what we needed to do to elevate the grounds and the security provision at those grounds to something that would be fitting for a World Cup, a global event. So I guess that without knowing that that's what I was doing, Phil, I was probably doing my first formal, in the private sector, formal threat assessment and management. Of course, working in the capacity that I did with the president, we were doing that every single day. You know, we were managing and assessing and mitigating risks and threats. And if I may, Phil, by way of introduction, also just pause to say that it wasn't all about me. I was one team leader, and there were four protection teams. If you know how our crazy government works, we actually have three capital cities. So we have the executive capital, which is in Pretoria. We have the legislative capital, where our parliament sits, which is in Cape Town. And then our judicial capital, where the Supreme Court of Appeal sits, is in Bloemfontein. So there were two protection teams in Cape Town for when Parliament sits pretty much the first half of the year. and two protection teams up in Pretoria, and I was the team leader of one of those. And it was a very curious time, very historic time, because I can't think of another body of people thrown together at a particular time in history who were absolutely mortal enemies. I'm talking about white cops coming out of the apartheid era police force, together with black, predominantly black, liberation movement soldiers, people that we considered to be terrorists, and told that we had to protect the most famous man in the world. Now, I still get slight chills when I think back on that responsibility that we were given. And we had to figure it out. We were like two buffalo bulls at the beginning. And if you've seen the movie Invictus, much of what is portrayed there about how those two teams of bodyguards interacted is absolutely accurate. And yet, you know, that was foisted upon us by history. And of course, it's 5 years that I'm extremely proud of, easily the best 5 years of my life. So I served from 94, when he became president, until, as I said, June of 99, when he stepped out of office. So that's how I would describe myself. And I've been in private security practice. I still partly own the security company that I started together with my partner, the late Bob Nichols, who's British by birth, came out to South Africa as a lad of, I think, around 16 years old. All of his training was in the private sector in Britain. He was neither a cop nor a soldier or sailor or airman. And we decided to start a security company up until his death, not even 2 months ago, we still co-owned that security business. So it's something I'm rather proud of, that record. 24-year-old security business coupled with 18 years almost of policing means that it's time to retire, Phil.
Well, listen, firstly, obviously, his death is probably still quite raw for you. And
yes,
you know, that's obviously a huge loss to you and to his family. So that's something to be recognized.
Indeed. Thanks, Phil.
So before you was selected then to look after Mandela, were you already a bodyguard?
Yes and no. I had certainly done the South African Police Force's close protection training course. And what had happened was, if you just think back to those heady days, that the last white state president of South Africa, Mr. de Klerk, stood up at a famous opening of parliament. In February, we always open parliament the first week of February. And he made this historic speech saying that he would unban the ANC and the Communist Party and all the banned organizations that formed essentially the greater anti-apartheid movement. And he would release Mr. Mandela and all the political prisoners unconditionally. So to say that was a groundbreaking announcement was kind of an understatement. And at the time, I was actually a member of the special branch in South Africa, the notorious John Forster Square special branch. And, you know, the apartheid system was essentially a set of laws. So racism existed and still does in many countries in the world, if not all of them, you know, on many levels and in various forms, Phil, but only South Africa legislated it. So they made, you know, marriage across the color line a law. They made the fact that people of a certain skin color could only live in a certain area a law. So when Mr. de Klerk makes this announcement and then ultimately finds those laws off the statute books, then the special branch had no more work, essentially, because the work of the special branch at the time was to protect the state, which was the apartheid state, against any threats to it. So they didn't know what to do with this young, very green still, kind of wet behind the ears, Lieutenant Steyn. And they said to me, well, you go and start a VIP protection unit. Because what the commanders knew was that as soon as he made that announcement, the diplomatic community and the business community of South Africa, who would never have thought of having anything to do with a National Party cabinet member, now all of a sudden wanted every piece of them that they could get. Because, okay, so this is the grand announcement that the state president has made. But what does that look like? Every ambassador was instructed to report back to his or her head of state or government about, you know, how does that translate into a formal political strategy? Because everything has just changed. And so did the business community, who had thus far been denied access in so many ways to the world's markets because of sanctions and other isolation. You know, what does this look like now for business opportunity? I mean, South Africa has got one of, if not the most modern banking systems on the planet. I mean, I go to Britain, I just shake my head. I can't believe how archaic the banking system there is compared to ours. You know, we've got this global economy built on gold. You know, as soon as all the tech stocks fail and the stock exchanges get wonky, everybody goes back to gold. And South Africa, until a few years ago, was sitting on top of the world's biggest gold deposit ever. And so business and the diplomatic community wanted to know. So they were traveling. These ministers, all of a sudden, were flavor of the month, coming to the chambers of commerce, coming to the embassies, and they needed some form of protection. So you go and start the VIP protection section in Joburg. And so that was 1990. Phil, fast forward the movie 4 years to 1994, and I've all of a sudden got a brand new president who has both a home and an office in Johannesburg, where I'm still the commander of the VIP protection unit of the police. So I was spending three quarters of my life, my working day, going and doing what you and I and everybody listening knows as advanced security. So we were going and securing, taking the sniffer dogs, the canine units, posting my men and women at the whatever venue or location he was having breakfast or making a speech or having a meeting at, until in January of 1996, I received a call from the head of the Presidential Protection Unit, because that unit did not exist in 1994 when Mandela became our first democratic president. It was all still being evolved, as I alluded to earlier. And by now, it had been properly constituted, and the commander was the colonel who had conducted my police VIP training all the way back in 1987. And he said, "Rory, the current team leader, a bloke by the name of Etienne van Eck, is going to study in Canada. He's still there. He's never come back. You are the same rank, the right rank, in other words, to be a team leader. The president knows you. You know him. The teams know you. You know them. Would you consider applying for that position?" You know, I think he was looking for a quick fix because, you know, my rank was right. Everything was right. So I asked him for 24 hours to discuss it with the government at home, and my wife and I discussed this and decided this is an opportunity not to pass up. And I phoned him back the next day and took the job and transferred to Pretoria. So it's nothing about any cliche of being handpicked or carefully selected or any of that stuff. I was purely in the right place at the right time. And as you do at this age, I'm 60 this year, and you look back at your life and you see the golden thread that runs through it. You can almost see how everything that had happened thus far in an almost 18-year police career, or almost 13-year at the time police career, was leading me towards this position, a very demanding one, you know, one demanding the utmost loyalty to the office of the head of state, even though the person occupying that office should really have been my enemy. And yet, due to his very own graciousness, you know, we all know the grand narrative of Mandela, don't we, Phil? But, you know, the prisoner who became president, the freedom fighter who came out of jail after 27 years and extended the hand of reconciliation, not the fist of retribution. It's an extraordinary story. And, you know, as I say, we should have been the bitterest of enemies. And yet he treated me with nothing other than respect. And our relationship grew to one of almost familial love between a grandfather and a grandson. And I say again, not just me. We as the white protectors learned from our African colleagues that in their culture, the generation of a Mandela is one of a grandfather to us, the men and women of the protection teams. And African people do not do what we Westerners do, where we are too quick very often to put our old folks into a retirement village or a retirement home somewhere and visit them half a dozen times a year. African people will never do that, because in their culture, all the wisdom of a society is vested in the elders. And so they revere their elders. They look up to them as this repository of community wisdom and leadership. And so we learned to address the president, not in a familiar way. It wasn't a term of familiarity, but we listened to and watched how our African colleagues would refer to him as Tata, which means father, and it's short for Tata Omkulu, which is the father who is great, or grandfather. So there was this relationship, and he would say to us, sometimes he would get a little bit beady with us if we would tell him, no, Tata, you can't go there, or we really shouldn't do it that way. And he said, you must remember that I am your grandfather. You know, so don't talk to me like that. You know, you're too young in the family, kind of thing. But black and white and every color in between, we learned to revere him and to love him in that capacity, because he would always look out for us in as much as we were called upon to look out for him and his safety. For.
And so when you first took on the role, I mean, in South Africa, are you protecting the person or the position?
Both. It's right. Both full. So essentially you are called to protect the office, irrespective of who the incumbent is. But just because of the way South Africa is, and certainly the way that politics are, and there's too much of a blurring of the state and the party, very much you are protecting the leader of that party in his or her personal capacity, as well as whatever office they're holding.
So when you first joined, totally. Yeah. No, I'm just because in the UK, we protect the person, but I know in the US, they protect the role. So
they protect the office.
Yeah, exactly. So when you first set up this team, and, you know, you were looking after Mandela, why is he called Mandiba? What's the difference
Madiba.
Between? Yeah. What's the two terms?
So the best way that I have understood that, because I did ask my black colleagues. So President Mandela is he's a member of the Tembu tribe. The Abatembu people have their own king. They come from the Eastern Cape, where the majority, certainly the language even that the Abatembu speak is Xhosa. And the Xhosa nation is the largest African tribe that comes from the Eastern Cape. So, you know, we have 11 official languages, right? We have English and Afrikaans, which were always official languages. And then we have 9 African tribes, each of which is home language is recognized. So isiXhosa, which the people from the Eastern Cape and the Western Cape speak, come from the Eastern Cape. And the Abotembu is also a tribe. You know, it's a separate identity from the Xhosa, but that's the language that they speak. Now, in the Abatembu, the Madiba family line, the bloodline of the Madibas, are the advisors to the king. So in his heritage as a Madiba, he would be an advisor to the king of the Abatembu. So when you call him Madiba, you're not being familiar, because to the Western ear, it is familiar to call a president a one-word name. You think it's some kind of a first name, but it's not. Like with the eldership, by calling him or referring to him as grandfather, you are acknowledging his status in society as an advisor to the king. So when you call someone Madiba, you are acknowledging that role, that status within the tribe.
Well, that's really interesting. I bet there's very few people that know that and thought it was a nickname or something like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. And so we, as you know, as the white cops that came to work and to serve on this team, and the rest of South Africa's white population, we didn't initially know that. we all had to find out why our black African compatriots referred to him as Madiba. That's why, if you watch the 95 Rugby World Cup final, the historic rugby final where he hands the World Cup to Francois Pienaar, when he walks onto that field in front of a overwhelmingly white crowd, I mean 98, if not 99.8% white rugby supporters in Ellis Park, probably 60% of them Afrikaners, and they see him in that sick shirt, they start to chant his name. And they're chanting his first name. They're chanting, Nelson, Nelson. And I remember physically pinching myself. I could not believe what I was hearing. But they didn't chant Madiba, which is what would have happened if he'd walked out at a football match where there would be have been a predominantly black crowd. So we were still learning that. Now people comfortably refer to him as Madiba, because we now get that, but we were all learning it. We, as the white folks of South Africa, were learning it at the time.
So when you first started protecting him, where was the threat coming from? What was the threat to him?
Great question, Phil. So the obvious threat would have been the right wing, because there was a hardline right wing resistance to any form of democratic election. So once State President de Klerk announced that that was the route. So remember, that was February of 94 that he made that announcement. The 2nd of February, Mandela walked out of prison 9 days later on the 11th of February. And in April of 94, so a mere 2.5 months later, on the 27th of April, South Africa went to the polls in what was our first democratic election. What do I mean by that? Where every South African above the age of 18, irrespective of the color of their skin, could vote. And he was ultimately elected. Now, leading up to that election day on the 27th of April, a bomb exploded, planted by the right wing. A bomb exploded in Joburg, where I was. By then, I was not just the head of the police's VIP protection unit. I was also the head of the bomb disposal unit. And as I say, five consecutive nights, five bombs. Planted by the right wing, saying we are not having this election. How there wasn't a polling station that was bombed on election day, which was that day, the 27th of May, is only by the grace of God. I remember driving around in an unmarked police car, literally waiting for the radio call to say which polling booth had been attacked. And mercifully, none were. And so on the 10th of May, he becomes our first Democratic president. So obviously, the threat predominantly would have been from that faction of right-wing society, because they had access to explosives. I mean, South Africa, as I was saying, is a mining community, especially Joburg. So accessing explosives would have been very easy. And they all had military training, because under apartheid, every white South African male above the age of 18 had to do 2 years of compulsory military experience. Only males and only white males. And so there was a lot of military training expertise amongst the right wing, as well as access to not just explosives, but also to firearms, because firearms are legal. You can legally own firearms, handguns, shotguns, rifles, of the hunting as well as of the assault variety, although you cannot own a fully automatic assault rifle. But security companies are able to have semi-automatic assault rifles licensed. So there was no problem for a right-wing militia ideological movement to arm themselves with explosives and weapons. So that's the first threat. Sorry for the long-winded answer. Surprisingly, to me even, as I think by then, a not unseasoned VIP protection police officer, I was surprised to find that there was a significant insider threat from within the president's own party. Why? Well, because many of the commanders of the liberation movement were promised certain senior positions in the military, in the police. And if they didn't get them, there was a degree of disgruntlement with their lot that they expected and didn't get. And that actually did take me by surprise. And then, of course, you know, there's the very small majority of mentally unstable people, somebody who, you know, doesn't necessarily even know why he wants to cause damage to somebody else's person. And if he chooses this guy that he constantly sees on TV as the target, well, you need to take that threat into account. So we would obviously get reports from South Africa's intelligence community that there were threats against him. But you know what? When you're working on a protection detail like that, and when you're protecting the most famous person in the world, I dare say that irrespective of intelligence reports coming through or not, you have literally got to be on it each day, you know, that you report for duty. And you know, Phil, I often remark that we didn't have the educational standards of the London Metropolitan Police, you know, either the Special Branch or the Royalty Protection Unit. We certainly didn't have anything approaching the budget that the United States Secret Service will throw around in the protection of their president and vice president. But we became very, very good at actively protecting against those threats that were there, including the incredible magnetism of a man who could, you know, who could draw a crowd. So, you know, those would predominantly be the threats that, you know, we were looking at on a daily basis.
And what about threats to you as, you know, white cops that were now protecting this once perceived enemy of the state? Were there threats against you and your families and your colleagues?
There were at times. I can tell you that because of the background that I explained to you, for coming out of a special branch background and then having to integrate with our enemy, you know, I was called a lot of things, both behind my back and to my face. I have to say that I never, certainly it was never reported to me that my family was under any threat or in any danger. But I was aware that, you know, as the faces of the protection team become more widely seen in the public space, that there could be people that would choose to, you know, target us. That never happened, but it wasn't something that we were unaware of. It wasn't something that we considered impossible, even though we were armed police officers trained in protection. We didn't discount the fact that, you know, some person might choose to take issue with us, but not our families. I don't remember ever feeling that my family was under threat.
So,
although I did stop doing bomb disposal when our first child was born. I thought that was a prudent move.
Yeah. Yeah. So talk me through then, you know, you're going out on a visit somewhere with Mandela. Now we know, yeah, or you know, my perception from what I've seen on TV and news and everything else is that he very much liked to be in with the crowd. He liked to you know, shake hands and be one with the people. How would you in those days then plan those security details when you know that's what he's going to do? He's going to be surrounded by, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, of people. How do you do that?
So, Phil, that's a great question because you're quite right. You know, and you can put yourself, you know, if you can, in the shoes of somebody who was in prison for 27 years and understand this huge desire to just interact with ordinary people. And President Mandela loved that. It would drive us crazy, but I got it. I understood the fact that if he, especially when he was, for example, courting Mama Grasa, you know, the lady that he married on his 80th birthday, and who became the only woman in history to be married to two heads of state, because her first husband was the president of Mozambique, who tragically died in an aircraft crash. And then she married President Mandela while he was still president. So if he wanted to go and buy flowers, or jewelry or chocolates, he would insist on going himself. And we would say to him, Dada, please give us the money and tell us what you want. And we'll go, no, I want to choose them myself. Which really meant that I want to just go and walk around in the shopping mall and go and see what jewelry and chocolates and flowers are available. Which sounds simple to you and me, but when Nelson Mandela walks into Sandton City to go to Godiva Chocolatier to choose some chocolates for his sweetheart, and this is before social media, this is the 90s we're talking about, it caused utter pandemonium. When Mamgrasa flew from Maputo in Mozambique down to Joburg to come and stay with him, he would insist on going to the airport to go and meet her. And again, we would say, please, let us go and fetch Mom. No, I want to meet her. Then he would walk into the arrivals hall and cause utter mayhem there that we had to deal with. But in many ways, Phil, it's an absolute fact that if we didn't know that he would tell us in the car on the way back from the office that he wants to quickly go and buy chocolates, then how are the bad guys going to know that? Mm-hmm. So you've got to be realistic about that sort of thing. But looking back on it now that I'm no longer the one having to deal with the pandemonium that he caused, I'm very happy that I served a president who wanted to be with his people. I think that's pretty cool. It's commendable almost. You know, I want to get out on the ground and just spend time with ordinary South Africans. And, you know, Phil, ordinary South Africans is one thing, but children was entirely another. If we were in any building or at any location where he was, and there were children even within sight of the door when he walked out, we knew, not maybe, 100% he's going to those kids. So we had already adapted our protection strategy. We would send members of our protection team over there to go and brief the kids and their teacher and just say, look, the president may be around somewhere here, and he may come over to you. We knew he was definitely going there. And we would tell them, don't all rush at him. Don't try and jump on him, because then we're going to have to pull you off. Behave yourselves. And we would say to the teacher, you know, do these kids know the words to Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star? Because the president's probably going to want to sing with them, not to them, with them. And again, I'm proud of the fact that I had a president who loved children. So it was in many ways a privilege to see the way, you know, he interacted with ordinary people and children in particular.
And what about foreign trips? Because, you know, yes, okay, you're in South Africa and you're in home territory and you know what you're doing. But when you're flying around the world as you did, because, you know, let's be honest, he was hot property. Everybody wanted Mandela to come and see him, to meet them and all that sort of thing. So how did you manage that? How did you, you know, I know you and I have talked about a couple of trips in London, but generally speaking, what were the threats? What were the pressures? What were the issues you were thinking and dealing with when doing foreign trips with Mandela?
Sure. Well, as you know, Phil, being a police officer yourself, that whenever you travel abroad with a head of state, the overall security for that visit resorts with the host nation. And when I get on the jet and come across with him or go across as part of the advanced team, I go with that understanding in mind that we're in your hands. This is your country. But we are coming with our president and we work with him, 24/7. So let's do this together, number one. And number two, when you come to our country, you know, the shoe will be on the other foot. So it really is a matter of reciprocity and of one hand washing the other. And so that's the first thing I'll say. The second thing I'll say is that we were utterly egalitarian in the presidential protection unit in that we had a roster with all the names of the Pretoria unit and the Cape Town unit's protectors. And every overseas trip that came up, irrespective of where it was going, there was no picking and choosing. When your name came up, then you were on the trip. What that meant was we would send a planning officer, up to a couple of months in advance, as we did in 96 when he came to the UK on that famous state visit. We went in May to plan it, and the visit happened in July. Then we would send an advance team maybe a week in advance of the president's arrival, and then one one person would travel, one of our team only would travel with him on the aircraft, because it was quite a small aircraft. And there was typically just a private secretary, a doctor, a protection officer, and his, what Americans would refer to as his chief of staff, who was a wonderful old guy. He's also not here any longer. Professor Harrell, he was an academic, wonderful man. And he would, so it would literally be four people on the plane. And we would fly in with him on the understanding that when we arrive there, the planning officer and the advance team have worked together with our host nation's police service. And we've got the protection detail squared away. It's ready to go. The plan is written. It's been communicated to everybody that needs to know. And one of the most difficult things was getting people to understand, you know, how big a visit by Mandela was. Even the British, I remember in the first meeting explaining to them, guys, you do realize that Nelson Mandela is coming to London. And they were going, yeah, but we've just had Gorbachev and we've just had the Pope. I said, that's all very well. They aren't Madiba. Wait until you see. And there's that famous incident where things went a little awry in Brixton. And we had to evacuate the president, as well as put your very, very recently crowned king into his car, because all the other cars got blocked in the melee that happened in the street in Brixton. And we had, as he was then, Prince Charles in the wrong car with Madiba and his daughter. And we had to skedaddle out of Brixton in a little bit of a hurry. And it was so weird to me on Saturday to watch parts of the coronation and to think back on that one incident. But again, he just drew crowds. And the only reason, because the bobbies in Brixton were doing their job that day. They were on the right side of the crowd barriers. Well, first of all, they had erected the crowd barriers down either side of the main street in Brixton. This massive crowd turned up, you know, 15, 20 people deep at the crowd barrier. The bobbies were on the street side of the barrier facing the crowd from where any threat would come from. But when you've got thousands, tens of thousands perhaps, of really jubilant, exultant people, if they start to jump over the crowd barriers, you know, you might catch one, two, and three that jump over, but four, five, six, and the rest are in the street really quickly. And I had this mob running at my president, and I knew that they were going to trample him. And it was nothing other than love, excitement. But my training also told me that there comes a point where an individual stops thinking and behaving like an individual, and mob psychosis takes over, and it's a very real thing. And the mob takes on an agenda of its own full. And we got him out of there before that happened. And as I say, we put King Charles in his vehicle as well, because we couldn't get not a single other vehicle out other than this beautiful Rolls Royce that the Queen had made available to the president for his state visit. There wasn't a panel on that beautiful motor car that wasn't dented by the people of Brixton and the horses' rumps after the bobbies brought the riot horses in there, cleared some space, and we got the Rolls moving. And as I'm looking for my black Rover, driven by the special branch of the London Metropolitan Police Service, that was stuck. The only thing coming out of the melee behind us were the motorcycles of the SEG. The SEG, the Special Escort Group of the Met, is the finest, I believe, police escort group for VIP and dignitary movements that I've ever seen anywhere in the world, because London is not designed in grids like New York City or Manhattan, for example. It just happened over centuries in this higgledy-piggledy crazy way. And so you've really got to know your route, and you've got to temporarily close intersections to allow a VIP motorcade to roll through there. You can't block a traffic light for 10 or 15 minutes in anticipation of a VIP car come through. The people of London would be up in arms, and the Prime Minister would probably lose his job the next day. So it was an interesting time, but the point is, Phil, that he drew huge crowds wherever he went. I mean, from Brixton, when we got out of there, we went to Trafalgar Square, because that's where the South African High Commission sits, South Africa House, And we dropped off on the far side of Trafalgar Square. And again, the Bobbies had erected crowd barriers snaking between the monuments and the fountains and the memorials and the columns there, right across Trafalgar Square to the far side where South Africa House sits. And they'd closed parts of the road. And the crowd in Trafalgar Square that day was easily the size of any crowd that you draw on New Year's Eve every year as people celebrate the bringing in of the new year. I mean, he went into the doors of that High Commission, previously our embassy, and it did not escape me, Phil, that here was the man that personified the end of that anti-apartheid demonstration that happened for 20 years or more outside South Africa House, whether it was one person or 200 people demonstrating there, there was always somebody demonstrating. And now the man that personifies the end of the need for such a demonstration, and having realized the freedom of his country and that of his people, is walking through those big wooden double doors. It didn't escape me. And we went up a lift, and we came out onto that balcony where there were those two columns, and there was this massive crowd in Trafalgar Square. And I remember getting kind of behind one of the columns so that I was out of sight of the TV cameras that were capturing all of us. And there stood the president with his arms aloft, saying to this huge crowd, just celebrating, he said to them, "I wish I had big enough pockets so I could take all of you home to South Africa with me." And it was just this surreal moment. Again, I remember physically pinching myself to think that here I am. Who am I? Some random cop from Joburg is experiencing and witnessing history like this, just like all of you experienced on Saturday. Tremendous privilege, Phil, is the best way to describe this time that I had with him.
So you know, you were with him for 5 years. You saw, you know, positives, yes, negatives, everything. What describe him? What was he like as a man?
Another good question. And for everybody listening, we haven't even consulted on these questions. These are purely those that Phil scripted, and we decided to have a conversational chat. So, Phil, it is a question that I'm asked pretty often, even from the days that I started there, when it was like, what? Mandela's got a white guy and other white men and women as part of his protection team. What the heck? And then obviously once the initial surprise is over, they would say, what's he like? So it's a question I've been asked thousands of times. And the best way that I can describe it, and also the greatest compliment that I can pay him, is to tell you, everybody listening, that if you never met Mandela, how you perceive him off a TV screen, that is exactly how he is. It's such a compliment to him to say to you that he never had a public and a private face. So he didn't have this electorate facing guy trying to win votes and stay in office. And then you people like us who were close to him, who saw him at his best and at his worst, understood who the real guy was. No, no, no. The way that he spoke to another head of state is the way that he spoke to the gardener. And it was the same way that he spoke to his family and the same way that he spoke to us. And that is so rare, Phil, as you know. Amongst human beings, it's rare. It is extremely rare amongst politicians. So that's the first thing I'd say, that how you perceive him is how he is. You don't discover that there's another side to him. He could laugh. He loved laughing. He could laugh at himself. And that's always a good thing. I think that a measure of a man or a woman and of their confidence, their self-confidence, is whether he or she can laugh at themselves and laugh with other people, not at other people. And he had a wonderful sense of humor. I mean, I'll tell you a story that he often told. So we would hear all his stories, and some of them we heard over and over and over again, but he tells the story of, I don't know where he was, I forget, but he was sitting down somewhere when, as he described it, a young lady came into the room, and she must have been, I don't know, about 10 years old. And she said to him, "Why did they put you in prison?" And he said, "I don't know. Maybe they didn't like me. I'm not sure why they put me. How long were you in prison? I don't know, he said. It was a long time. And she said, and who put you there? And he said, I'm not sure. You know, maybe some people that didn't like me. And she said, you are a stupid old man. Because every question that she asked, he said, I don't know. And her reading of that was, you're a stupid old man. And he would tell that story and throw back his head and laugh along with the rest of us that had heard it. And we loved the fact or the time for that he would push aside the prepared speech and start to speak off the cuff or from the heart, because then we would really listen. And we knew that he would tell one or more of those stories. So he was utterly consistent in the way that he treated people. He loved to laugh and he enjoyed humor. And he was an extremely generous person to us as his bodyguard. He would always ask us and make sure that we had been fed, that we'd been taken care of. He knew our children's names. He invited our families one spring day. So spring in the Northern Hemisphere is 1st of March, and where we live, it's the 1st of September. And this particular year, it was 96 or 97. You can check. It was a Saturday. And he invited all of our families to tea at his official residence. And he had two chairs placed on the what we call the stoop. What is a stoop in English? Outside the back door of the residence in the sun. And he sat there with our wives next to him, and the kids climbed onto his lap. And we stood behind these two chairs, and every family got a photograph with him. And so from that day onwards, whenever we said to our wives, hey, babe, I'm sorry, we've got to work late, they would say, yeah, no problem, that's fine. Because who invites, you know, the families to tea and gets to know them? There was his official vehicle driver in Cape Town. His wife gave birth one day while we were all with the president at Parliament. And once word reached the president's ears that his wife was coming home the next day or the day after, whatever it was, with the newborn baby, he said, let's go. And we got in the car straight from Parliament and drove to their home. And in he went and had tea with them, the wife still in a slightly tender position, having just given birth to this newborn child. But that's how he was, you know. One day we landed early on a Friday, coming up. I don't know why the parliamentary session ended at about lunchtime that week. So we thought, bargain, we're going to have an early long weekend. We're going to land just after lunch, 2-3 in the afternoon, drive him home, and that'll be it. He'll gather his newspapers and sit and read, and we can all go home. And he said to me as we landed, he said, Rare, man, I want to go to this hospital somewhere on the East Rand of Joburg. And I said, Dada, why do you want to go there? I know it's not on the schedule. And he said, man, there is a young lady there who wrote me a letter. And so in South Africa, we have, as I suppose in most countries, we have something called the Reach for a Dream Foundation, where children with terminal diseases can write or get someone to write for them to the foundation and tell them what their final wish would be. And this young girl, Afrikaans girl of maybe 12 or 13, I think she had leukemia, sitting in the hospital dying, and she wrote that she'd like to meet the president. And somehow that note got through all of the doorkeepers and actually got in front of him. And he said, no, we're going Secunda. That's the name of the town, a mining town on the East Rand of Joburg. We're going to go to Secunda Hospital. And I don't know what it is about nurses, but whenever Nelson Mandela walked into a hospital, they completely lost their heads. They were dancing and ululating and singing, and all the patient's needs were forgotten, and the whole hospital was up in arms and everybody. And he went and sat with this girl for maybe half an hour and just spoke to her one-on-one. And then he came out of her ward and he went straight into the rest of the children's section, all of the wards in the children's section. And he went to every bed and he chatted to the kids with all of this pandemonium created by the nurses going on. And then we left. So we ended up not having an early Friday afternoon and a long weekend. But again, I say to you, Phil, that I'm glad that that's the kind of president that I served. And, you know, he didn't need to do that. He was, you know, he was an elderly man getting on, he had a long week. The easy way out would have said to the guys, okay, boys, take me home and you can all have a long weekend. No, I remembered this young lady. We're going to go there to that hospital. And, you know, I mean, I barely had enough time to call ahead and get the local cops to go there, just have a bit of a presence on the ground because nobody knew we were coming at all up until, you know, we landed. So, yeah, that's, again, a long-winded answer, Phil, but it's an accurate way of describing who he was as a person, as a human.
So, Rory, listen, I'm so grateful for your time because I know how precious it is, and I know you've got other engagements, and I know you're a very popular speaker. Now, you know, you wrote a book about it, your time. What's the book? What's the book called?
It's called One Step Behind Mandela, courtesy of my mother. So there was a working title that we had. I got a female journalist to write it. So it's my story as told to, because she was already a published author. And I had three criteria when selecting somebody to co-write. My dad was a journalist, by the way, and he instilled in me a love of language generally, but specifically a love of the English language, and good written and spoken English were things that I inherited from him. But I was still working with the president at the time, and I just didn't feel confident enough to actually write my own book. I think if I ever wrote a sequel, I would probably attempt to do it on my own. One was that it needed to be somebody who understood the political context in South Africa pre and post 94. And she ticked that box because she was a journalist with one of our talk radio programs and did a lot of political reporting on the violence and the other issues leading up to the election and then you know, the transition to democracy after it. So that was fine. And then a second criteria was I wanted a female perspective because ours is a very chauvinistic, testosterone-driven environment if you work in a protection team, even though we had female police officers on our team and may I say, extremely good ones. It was, you know, the whole bodyguard, and we don't like that word much, do we, Phil? We prefer protection officer. So the whole protection officer world is it's a male one. It's a patriarchal testosterone environment. And I wanted a woman's perspective. And the third criterion was that it needed to be somebody that the president knew and trusted, because I would never write a book which would be a kind of a kiss and tell and telling dark secrets, not at all. The purpose of writing the book was precisely because whenever anybody asked me, what's it like working for President Mandela? And I would tell them some of the, even just one of the stories that I've told you, they would say, oh, that's incredible. You should write a book one day. And I did. I wanted to write a perspective, particularly to white South Africans of my generation, explaining from a very personal perspective, the very fundamental way he influenced my life and changed my own understanding and perspective of history and race in my own country. And I just wanted a forum, a mouthpiece, a way to tell that story. And it's, you know, it's 23 years now out of print, because the book was published in 2000, but you can still get it in the Kindle store. And if you're really lucky, you can get a few secondhand copies on Amazon.co.uk or Amazon.com. There are a few hard copies floating around. But that was the motivation for writing the book, Phil. Yeah.
Well, it's well worth a read. Now, lastly, where can people find you? So your consultancy, NSA Global, people do want to get a hold of you for professional reasons, how do they get a hold of you?
Thank you, Phil. That's very simple. It's nsa-global.com.
Fantastic.
That's our website. There's an info@mailbox on there. There's also a rorys@nsa-global.com email address, which comes directly to me. And it's very kind of you to make that known, Phil. And thank you. I've done all of the talking. I hope I haven't bored you and your listeners. And I hope I've answered all your questions, mate.
Well, firstly, no one listens to the podcast for me. So that's the main pit. So trust me, they won't be downloading it to listen to me. They're downloading it to listen to you. So that's the most important bit. And we're going to put all those details on the, we'll put all those details on the notes. So anyone who does want to find out more about you or get a hold of you for professional reasons can do so. You know, Rory, it's been such an honor listening to all these wonderful stories about a man that, you know, very few of us across the world will ever have actually met, and even right. fewer will have really known. But to listen to your experiences and your humility when one considers the kind of place you came from into that role and all the history and politics that goes along with that, it's fascinating. And I never get bored of listening to your stories. But
thank you.
You know, thank you so much. Rory, a huge pleasure. And I look forward to catching up for another beer very, very soon.
Very soon. And Phil, thank you for doing this. I know how difficult it is at times to arrange speakers, and I commend you for it. And I encourage you, you know, to keep the podcast going, because there is much that people, ordinary people, not even police officers or those involved in private security, can learn. So as you and I were speaking about the conference that we had that beer at, you know, mental health, public health, education, as well as security and law enforcement are areas where threat assessment and management is practiced. And I just, as I say, I encourage you and I commend you to keep this going, mate. It's a vital platform. People need to hear stories of people who've been there at the coalface, you know, doing this kind of stuff that we do on a daily basis.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that. Appreciate it. And I will, I'll take you up on that invitation to come and see you as well. So,
yes, sir. Please do come and visit us and come and see the elephants, and the giraffe and the zebra.
Right. Okay, Rory, that's enough of that. My wife will be booking tickets before I know it. So,
there we go.
Yeah. Okay, lovely. Rory, thank you so much.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a great day.
Thank you for listening to the Online Bodyguard podcast with host Philip Grindel, CEO and founder of Diffuse. Please rate, review, and subscribe on your favorite podcasting platforms.